This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Ruxandra Guidi is no stranger to deadlines. She's been working as a journalist and a storyteller for close to two decades for outlets like the New York Times, the BBC, and NPR. But lately, she's become increasingly interested in slowing down the storytelling process and seeing what happens if she gives herself a month or a year to tell a story instead of a day or a week. Slowing down has let her go deep and create projects like Going Gray in L.A. It's a multi-part multimedia series about aging in the city of glitter and glam. Ruxandra Guidi is the 2018 Susan Tift Fellow with Duke University Center for Documentary Studies, and she joins me now. Ruxandra, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. You moved to the U.S. from Venezuela when you were 14. What did you notice about perceptions of Latin America here in the U.S. when you got here?
You know, my first impression was that a lot of the kids in my high school class in Nutley, New Jersey, did not know where Venezuela was. So, you know, I'm not sure that that's representative of every high school classroom in America, but I really felt, you know, like we in America didn't have much of a sense of this very diverse, complex, you know, Western Hemisphere beyond what's south of Mexico. So, you know, you didn't hear much Spanish out in the streets back then. I was only one of two Latino kids in the town. Now that's really changed. You know, there's been a demographic change across the country. But back then, that really struck with me.
So what was your inspiration for becoming a journalist?
You know, I didn't go through the classic training of you know, working at the school newspaper or anything like that. I really was into politics. I majored in political science at Rutgers University, and I actually really had struggled with my college years. I almost dropped out of college, actually, and was lucky enough to take a class on Latin American literature by Tomás Eloy Martínez. He became one of my mentors, and he was a novelist and journalist in Latin America. And he really took me under his wing and just kind of exposed me to a lot of great writing and the possibilities of journalism.
What were those possibilities for you?
For me, it was really personal. It was about becoming reacquainted with the place that I was from, with the region, with telling stories about regular folks in ways that I wasn't seeing in the mainstream media with travel. I think many of us that get into journalism do because we want to see the world. But it was really also an effort in my own part to regain some of what I'd lost in college by almost dropping out. You know, I wasn't really passionate about learning for at first. I hadn't found my path yet. And journalism allowed me to really go deep into all these issues and basically re-educate myself, basically.
Well, you in graduate school, you reported for the first time on the U.S.-Mexican border, first time for you, on the U.S.-Mexico border. Tell us about that experience and what it taught you.
You know, I actually ended up reporting on the border after grad school, and that was I was working for Latino USA, the NPR public radio program, which then was based out of Austin, Texas. And it was a really small newsroom. I was a producer, but I was encouraged to go out and report as much as I wanted to. So I always say, you know, for people starting out, some of the best work you can do is by offering yourself up to do anything. You know, at smaller newsrooms, you get more of a chance to learn and pick up different skills. And that's what I did. I just started traveling down to Mexico and doing all sorts of stories. But for me, that was almost like training in foreign reporting. It was really what opened up my eyes about reporting on different communities, different cultures, and yet trying to almost translate this lived experience of others in ways that make it more accessible for audiences that don't like either romanticize or paint them as the other, which is what I had an issue with. You know, in journalism school, I felt like much of the work we consume as Americans about the rest of the world is coming from this perspective of we're all knowing. We can just drop in for a couple of days into a foreign environment and tell you all how exotic it is, you know, realizing that at the border, right between the U.S. and Mexico, there was another culture all completely different from the ones of the country to the north or to the south, to me was fascinating and something I needed to to communicate to audiences.
To audiences. Let's talk about that, because we just had this conversation a minute ago about covering white supremacists and the assumptions that a mostly white newsroom, which is mostly what you find in newsrooms in the United States of America, the kind of assumptions they would make about stereotypes and what you think of when I say white supremacist. But it raises an interesting question. You do a program like Latino USA, which is meant for a broad public radio audience, mm-hmm. whatever that looks like, but it's probably targeted and probably has a greater percentage of Latino, Latina listeners. So who's your, I mean, in a program like that, who are you writing for?
Right. You know, That's a great question. The reason why I got into journalism and then public radio in particular is because I believe in that mandate of, you know, smart content, smart storytelling for the general masses, right? But the folks that are listening to public radio are not that diverse, really. And I'm not sure about Latino USA's numbers specifically, but, you know, we often as journalists end up telling stories for ourselves, for people who look and sound just like us. So that's been part of my own challenge as a journalist, is to try to go above and beyond the outlet that it is that I'm producing something for, and really get stories back to the communities where I've been reporting and get them in multiple outlets and really face to face. Because I think if you just assume that a public radio listening audience is a reflection of America today, it really is not, right? I mean,
right.
We've
absolutely
been
not. No, I'll show you the demographics. It absolutely is not representative.
Yeah, it's not.
And so then you have to really stand on your head in order to say, okay, I know who's listening. How about if I did the show that they weren't expecting?
Yeah.
And maybe the only one to do it is the guy who looks exactly like the mainstream demographic.
Yeah.
And then I may be in a better position to flip it on its head than you are,
yeah.
in a sense, because I'm attracting people who then I flip some of their expectations. But that puts you in a, I mean, but you are who you are. You have your identity and your background. And you came to this, some understanding about how this works, I think, when you reported on a prison, right? You did some reporting in Latin America for U.S. publications, and in 2005, there was a prison in Honduras that you reported on. Tell us that
that's
story.
Right. Yes. So I actually was producing for Mandalita El Barco, who's a kind of our Latina public radio godmother for those of us who come from Latin America and have gone into public radio. That was really a documentary called After the Wars. And part of our story was to go to San Pedro Sula, which is considered one of the most, if not the most violent city in the world, in Honduras. And there's a few prisons there where a lot of Honduran deportees from America end up in once they're deported back to Honduras. I mean, a lot of these guys, most of these guys are convicted gang members and who've done horrible crimes, right? When we hear about the president talk about MS-13 today, that's what we're talking about. And, you know, it to me, it was incredibly eye-opening on many different levels. One, to be face-to-face, you know, talking to someone who may be 17 years old and is in prison for life for murdering, you know, other people. And yet you realize this is a child, right? And this is person's been painted a certain way by the media. And there's parts of his story that I'm learning right now that are not showing up in that story, right? And also to be in this city, San Pedro Sula, that's been painted as the most dangerous in the world, and to realize that life goes on for people there, right? In other ways, I mean, of course, violence shapes their everyday reality, but there's always more to the story. Maybe that's what I mean to say, and that was the big lesson I got. You know, I think for those of us that tell real life stories, we end up copying each other, right? We end up getting our ideas from other stories on the web, from Google, or from, you know, the fact that we see it on the cover of the New York Times. And that really limits our imagination, and it definitely affects our audiences. It shapes people's perceptions and biases about the world. And so I, you know, that experience in Honduras really said to me, I need to go out there and try to find the stories. One, I'd like to find stories that are hopeful in some sense, because I would like to inspire people. I like the idea of like being part of shaping our sense of hope in the world, right, rather than the demise.
Well, and if I may interrupt you, there's also a glimmer of hope in every story, and so maybe it's up to the reporter to say, in addition to all of this horrific stuff, and we don't want to be Pollyanna about how awful this is,
right?
Look what I found.
Yeah, definitely, right. Definitely, that's part of it. But it's also the idea of challenging the narrative, right? I think for a lot of American audiences, Latin America is still equated with violence or with like people who live in rural areas with chickens. I mean, I hate to sound crass, but that's often what I see. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to tell different stories, and that's been...
Is that the thinking behind, because you and your husband co-created an initiative called Fonografia, the Fonografia Collection. Tell us about that and that approach to storytelling.
Sure. So I actually had to talk a little bit about that yesterday. It's really Fonografia Collective is really a made up word. Fonografia does not exist in Spanish.
So I can pronounce it any way I want.
Right, exactly. You did a great job. So phono is sound, right? Grafia is document. We really wanted to come up with a word that expressed our collaboration, our work together. He's a documentary photographer. I do radio, oral histories, interviews. And we wanted to formalize our collaboration and make it clear to editors or anyone that we want to tell stories together. So that's simply our name, the name we use.
And this approach led to a number of stories. One of them is where you took a look at the people of the Kuna culture and talked to someone named Tomas de Leon. But tell us a little bit about the story. I want to play a clip here, but maybe you can set up the story for us.
Sure. This is a story that an editor I was working with at the time basically asked me to look into. It was bit complicated, but it boils down to the Kuna people are an indigenous community in Panama, on the Caribbean side of Panama, that have some of the best preserved old growth forests in Latin America, and they they live on islands in the Caribbean, but they have part of their sovereign territory is this mainland forest that's well preserved. And their conundrum is that because of climate change and sea level rise, they may be pushed out of those islands in the next couple of generations. And they're looking at the prospect of having to move to the mainland and what that would do to their forests. So it was really an environmental story that we try to put a face on.
Because told from afar, they were given the option of preserving their forest and receiving international money to do
this.
Right. And if you preserve the forest, obviously you sequester more CO2. Good for the environment generally. How much good it would do for them in the short run, we don't know. But they chose not to take it, right?
They chose not to take it. And we really wanted to shed light on some of the solutions that we come up with in the West for traditional peoples and for nature sometimes are just market-driven. You know, the story is much more complicated and nuanced than we often hear.
But again, if you're an environmentalist and a progressive, you think, well, why not take that deal? And of course, I want to play this clip now because you did talk with Tomas de Leon, who is a community leader. He was in his late 80s, and he talked about conservation and the way they saw that in the Kuna culture.
Old plants in Kuna culture have a role to fulfill, to support humanity. This is why Kuna people take care of all things that surround them, because there may come a time when nature will be useful to man, when disease or bad weather strikes.
That was a clip from an audio story produced by my guest, Ruxandra Guidi. She's the 2018 Susan Stift Fellow at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. She's going to be talking about her work at the center tonight in Durham here with me now. What should we take away from stories? How is that going to flip our understanding of some of these issues that we talk about daily in the news?
You know, I like to quote Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie a lot lately. She's this Nigerian novelist and feminist. She's fantastic if y'all haven't checked her out. She talks about, and she actually has this TED talk available online about the power of multiple stories, I think it's called. The danger of a single story, that's what it's called. I think it's quite simple. I think we are multifaceted people, not just in this society and in this culture, but around the world, you know. And there are multiple stories within a single subject, and more so we're talking about entire communities and peoples and countries and cultures. And so I'm very encouraged by the diversity, the growing diversity we're finding in the media today, and a push for diverse voices. And by diverse, I'm not just talking about like racial, ethnic, gender diversity. I'm talking socioeconomic, you know, geographic, across the board. I think we just need to be hearing from different people, different stories and different perspectives. And I think we need more personally, and I'm an advocate for this, and this is the kind of journalism I'm trying to do now, is I want to be more transparent with my readers, with my listeners, about what my views are, yeah, my opinions, my background. You know, I think that strengthens my reporting. It doesn't make me any less, I won't say
less credible.
Objective,
it does not make you less credible, because to some extent, number one, you've been fully transparent, but two, it gets back to the little conversation we had a second ago, that your self-awareness becomes a part of the story, and we shouldn't be ignorant of your self-awareness.
Absolutely.
That kind of objectivity is, in fact, negligence to some degree, wouldn't you say?
Of course, yeah. And I think we, all of us as journalists that are witnessing the changes that are happening in this society now under our new president, can say that it's definitely shaken our way of doing work and some of the principles we've been following to do journalism. So I think it's a fine moment to put a lot of those into question, you know, and mix things up.
Well, it's fine to have you here sharing those moments with us and your work. Ruxandra Guidi, a journalist and storyteller who co-created Phonographia Collective. that's the way we say it here in Durham. The 2018 Susan Tipp Fellow at Duke University Center for Documentary Studies. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
You can hear more about her work and storytelling this evening at the Center for Documentary Studies in Durham. We've got the details at our website, stateofthings.org, which is a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Robert Kinlaw, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.